faculty, it's my pleasure to welcome you here again this evening for this second in the series of public lectures on tensions in Luther's theology. As you probably know, the theologians who influence the life of any generation with profundity can usually be counted on the fingers of one hand. Gerhard Ebeling, our visiting professor, is one of these theologians, and therefore you can see how very exhilarating it must be for all of us, colleagues and students, to be so intimately associated with him here on the campus during this first semester. We're happy to be able to share him with this wider group during this series, and it's my deep personal privilege to be able to present him to you this evening in his second lecture on the tensions in Luther's theology, having to do with the tension between theology and philosophy. Professor Ebeling.
Ladies and gentlemen, in one of Luther's earliest letters, we find a statement about his relationship to philosophy and theology. It is a very personal expression which grows out of the situation of his work in this time. But precisely as personal, this note is like an unconscious motto of basic significance for Luther's subsequent path, not only for the coming course of his discussion of a specific problem of thought, but for the fundamental orientation of his thought in general. The letter was written in the spring of 1509, thus during the time of Luther's theological studies. It was written from Wittenberg, where he had been sent by his monastic order at Erfurt half a year earlier. In conformity with the academic customs of his day, he was teaching as Master of Arts in the Faculty of Liberal Arts, while at the same time studying theology himself. The Augustinian hermits of Wittenberg were constitutionally responsible for supplying two chairs at the university, the biblical professorship, which Luther took over as successor to Staupitz in 1512, during his second and final term in Wittenberg, and the professorship in moral philosophy, in which Luther, a 25-year-old theological student, had to interpret Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. He had just received the degree of Bachelor of the Bible, which meant he was also responsible for cursory interpretations of the biblical books. In describing his situation in this letter, he writes that by the grace of God he is well, except that his studies are very severe, especially philosophy, which from the first he would willingly have changed for theology. This refers to his Wittenberg activities. That is to say, he would have liked to replace it with the kind of theology which searches out the meat of the nut, the kernel of the grain, and the marrow of the bones. Luther states here a decisive predilection for theology against philosophy. He expresses this partiality not as one electing his courses. Theology was required by the prescribed curriculum of the order. His preference refers rather to the way to study theology. Even though the problem of an exchange of one academic subject for another, one scientific discipline for another, is in the foreground, it is no mere accident that Luther proceeds immediately to a critical elucidation of what he expects from theology and not from philosophy. However, he does not expect this from theology automatically, but from a correct, appropriate theology which does not remain superficial and which is not satisfied with empty shells, but pushes on to what is decisive, where it touches the heart of the matter, and therefore one's own heart as well. We already perceive here the impassioned will, which even at that time does not rest satisfied with the standard theology of scholasticism, but instead exacting the cause, and with himself. He insists on a truly theological theology. The desire expressed in this cannot be fulfilled by a theology in which philosophy is predominant, philosophically overrun theology, as one finds it at least in the systematic theology of scholasticism, and which to some extent reaches extreme forms in late scholasticism. This strikes the keynote which determines all of Luther's subsequent activity. A few years later, Luther formulates this keynote programmatically in his lecture on Romans. Indeed, I believe that I owe this duty to the Lord of crying out against philosophy and turning men to Holy Scripture. For perhaps if someone else who had not been through it all were to do it, he would either be scared to do it or he would not be believed. But I have been in the grind of these studies for, lo, these many years, and am worn out by it. And on the basis of long experience, I have come to be persuaded that it is a vain study, doomed to perdition. For this reason, I admonish you all as earnestly as I can, be quickly done with these studies, and let it be your only concern not to establish and to defend them, but rather to deal with them as with bad skills that we learn only in order to get rid of them, or as with errors that we take up in order to refute them. So we undertake these studies only in order to reject them, or at least for the purpose of getting acquainted with the manner of discourse of those with whom we have to maintain relations. It is high time that we be transferred from other studies and learn Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Of course, we would have understood Luther's concern very poorly and would certainly be subject to misunderstanding if you are satisfied with so general an observation of antithesis between philosophy and theology. Luther considers himself entitled to such a position because he really knows his way around in the subject of philosophy. Neither can we presume that we are able to understand Luther's statements without knowing their historical background. And we are even less justified in thoughtlessly appropriating Luther's polemic for ourselves, that is to say, apart from our own corresponding intensive experience with philosophy, and without realizing how different our situation is from Luther's. On the other hand, we need to be equally careful not to dispose of these statements as frivolous disdain of philosophy without ourselves penetrating into the circumstances and realizing what Luther meant here. For Luther was a keen and profound thinker. His opinion on philosophy was not guided by flight from thought, but by the discipline of proper theological thought. Neither was his whole interest in this question one of a general either-or between philosophy and theology. His main concern was rather for the either-or between good and bad theology, between theological and pseudo-theological theology, and for the meaning which the distinction between philosophy and theology would have for genuine philosophy. Theology and philosophy represent, in fact, two streams of tradition whose origin and nature are completely different. Theology represents the Christian faith, which originates in the world of Judaism determined by the Old Testament. Philosophy represents Greek thought, on whose soil the freedom of the human spirit for a rational questioning of being burst forth in a unique way. The union into which both of these lines of tradition entered, and from which originated the most powerful and the most differentiated historical context, has never been able to deny that it is a duality packed with tension. However, the idea that this association could and should in fact be dissolved is a foolish illusion in view of the actual course of history. As if one could cancel what has happened, or as if it were possible to withdraw from the historical depth and force of this connection of the Christian faith and Greek thought. It would be a sign that one had overlooked that at its roots the situation does not admit of being mixed in the simple formula of an interrelationship of two contradictory traditional trends which could be separated again. As much as the Christian faith is connected with the Old Testament, it still cannot be understood as a form of the Israelite Jewish religion. The affirmation that it is sent into the world and the belief that the heathens are called to faith without becoming Jews accomplished the definition of the cause of the Christian faith itself as early as the beginning of primitive Christianity. Paul does not see himself pushed into a would-be alternative as propagator of a proclamation hostile to the Greeks. He believes himself transposed to a third place, from which he bears responsibility for Jews and Greeks alike. Thus he faces both with the same openness, the same devotion, but also with the same willingness to oppose them. He does this in the certainty that the separation of Jews and non-Jews, of Greeks and barbarians, is abolished in faith. For, as we read in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, in the textual context which is of fundamental significance for Luther's position concerning the question of theology and philosophy, Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. The entry of the Christian message into the Greco-Hellenistic world is thus not an accidental occurrence which would pose a problem for the purity of the Christian faith. It is rather the necessary consequence of what is at stake in Christian faith. And therefore it occurs necessarily for the sake of the purity of this Christian faith. The fact that the New Testament is not written in Hebrew, like the Old Testament, but in Greek, is of deep significance. But since this freedom and power for a missionary encounter with the Greek spirit was part of the nature of Christian faith, this meant obviously that there was a readiness for confrontation with the strongest aspects of the Greek spirit, that is, with Greek philosophy. This confrontation was carried out systematically for the first time through the early Christian apologists, and then with the Alexandrians, Clement, and Origen, it grew into an intensive penetration of Greek thought, which was to become absolutely determinative for the subsequent course of the history of theology. It is understandable that the manner in which this confrontation of the Christian faith with Greek thought occurred gives the impression that an unusually dangerous course was followed, and that essential aspects of the Christian faith have been clouded over, weakened, and diminished, if not sacrificed altogether. Such a critical opinion may, of course, be justified, but its modifications should be debated in detail. In spite of this, one must not lose sight of the fact that since such a confrontation with philosophy was risked, we can see that the Christian faith was not understood to be a withdrawal into a ghetto, but a mission into the world. And it is precisely for the sake of its purity that this faith must expose itself to the critical process of such confrontations. The beginning of Christian theology can thus not be separated from the readiness to give a responsible account, to which in turn the Christian faith enables us with amazing radicality in distinction from all other religions. The term theology is indeed derived from the Greek, but in Greek thought it means first of all the mythological cultic language about the divine, which does not enter into confrontation with philosophy. Theology, in the sense familiar to us as a reflective answerability of faith itself, does not originate in the Greek world. It became possible only through the Christian faith, and cum grano salis, exclusively so. From the time of the early church, Christian theology is therefore always more or less intensively, Christian theology is therefore always more or less intensively in dispute with philosophy. And it is noteworthy that it has always been a characteristic of Orthodox theology decisively to affirm this. In any case, one was always conscious of a fundamental difference which was not to be eliminated. However, while a conversion to Christianity signified, as a matter of course, the abandonment and destruction of the pagan religions, at least in principle, it by no means resulted in the destruction of philosophy. By analogy to this, as we all know, the success of Christianity did not result in the abolition of the distinction of church and state. On the contrary, the depth of this distinction was realized and became effective, especially with Christianity. By the same token, once it had become generally and publicly acknowledged, the Christianity to which the remainder of the pagan religions, as well as the existence of an independent non-Christian philosophizing, fell prey, could by no means want philosophy per se to cease or to join so indistinguishably with the Christian faith that theology would be nothing but a Christian form of philosophy. It was rather in the interest of the Christian faith and of Christian theology itself that the heritage of the philosophical tradition would be preserved in its distinct individuality. This meant, however, that throughout the entire Middle Ages, philosophy was in a personal union with theology, but aware that tasks were not the same. To relate philosophy and theology in their correct distinctiveness is by nature the problem of Christianity. It is part of its nature as the tension of knowing and believing and of reason and revelation. This tension is inevitable, and the Christian cannot simply shake it off. He is charged with this tension and must endure it. These few strokes had to indicate the broad background of our theme this evening in order to call to mind the dimensions of the problem. If we have put the accent in a way which runs counter to Luther's intention, we must say that this was done as a preventive measure, for under the impression of the immediate frontal position in which Luther speaks and in which he must be understood, we must be careful that we do not lose sight of the principal aspects of the case. We shall now touch briefly upon the situation which determined Luther's discussion of this object. The main characteristic of so-called scholasticism is a specific understanding of science, which is fundamentally valid for all branches of science in the same way, hence, for example, also for mathematics and medicine. This understanding was built upon two principles, authority and reason. Authority was not a principle simply of the biblical and ecclesiastical tradition. The profane sciences also lived by the traditional work of antiquity, whose scientific knowledge had a validating authority, even in the natural sciences. For example, the scientific method consists of the interpretation of the authoritative texts and not of independent empirical research. This emphasis on the authority of tradition naturally rests on an interior coalescence of the medieval spirit, in which the authority of ancient science and the authority of the revelation tradition are so bound together that, in case of conflict, the authority of revelation decides the issue. Therefore, not only theology, but scholastic science at all is ecclesiastical science. And up to the High Middle Ages, when the universities came into being, the educational centers were institutions of the church, or at least institutions endowed with ecclesiastical privileges. In this kind of science, which is based on authority, the task of reason is to reconcile contradictions through the method of the syllogism, that is, by means of a dialectic. The sphere of this task was strictly limited by authority. However, within these limits, there was great latitude for intellectual activity, which reached unprecedented heights in the penetration and power of its systematic comprehension. This may have been due precisely to the manifold restrictions placed on reason against free-wheeling arbiters. In the early Middle Ages, the philosophical tools of antiquity which were available had been negligible. But on the threshold of the High Middle Ages, the disclosure of the complete Aristotelian corpus brought about a tremendous change in intellectual history. It was no accident that this discovery coincided with the zenith of papal influence, which dominated the world, and of the mendicant orders with their impressive impulse to missionize the world. In the beginning, the reception of Aristotle met considerable resistance, even on the part of the official church. However, the doubts vanished once the great possibilities for theology were realized. That is to say, such possibilities as a harmonious relationship between faith and reason, and the prospect of bringing together the horizons of the natural and the supernatural into an all-inclusive systematic whole. Thomas Aquinas deserves the great merit for accomplishing such a total view up to its minutest differentiations. He proceeded according to the principle, since grace does not destroy nature, but perfects it, natural reason should minister to faith, as the natural bent of the will ministers to charity. There can be a priori no contradiction between theology and philosophy. To be sure, revelation is super-rational, but not anti-rational. The truth of faith cannot be proved conclusively, but neither can they be disproved. They can be shown to be free of self-contradiction and can be related to natural reality analogously. In this way, reason was employed far more extensively. On the one hand, it was restrained. On the other, it was spurred on to triumphant achievements which brought reason to an awareness of its own dormant possibilities. And at the same time, in its relationship to the truth of revelation, it became more independent, self-willed, and less easily harmonized. It was precisely the Augustinian heritage, which strongly influencing the Franciscans, began to raise doubt as to whether the rational knowledge of the world and the church's dogma of faith could be joined seamlessly. The Aristotelian concept of science was retained, to be sure. If anything, its outlines became even more distinct. Theology, however, could no longer be characterized as science, except in a very limited and figurative sense. During the late Middle Ages, William of Ockham introduced nominalism. In contrast to Thomas, the concentration of thought was focused on pointing out the place in which faith and reason clashed. A distinction with regard to God supported this, for God, who in his absolute power, potentia absoluta, could have ordered everything differently, and whose acts are therefore not subjected to higher rules and necessities, in his ordained power, his potentia ordinata, limited himself to the actual conditions which he himself ordained. Philosophy and theology stand in sharp tension to each other in nominalism. And yet, a peculiar ambiguity exists in this tendency. On the one hand, a truly religious passion is at work.
the alien nature of the subject of theology, its antithesis to reason, and its foundation in faith and in the authority of revelation manifest themselves very strongly. On the other hand, the tension is precisely brought about through an increased and more formalistic use of reason, which obstinately tries to expose church dogma as an authority valid merely positivistically, neither to be proved nor substantiated. And it remains unclear whether this redounds to the honor of faith or of reason. In Erfurt, Luther was educated in the spirit of Occam. He was therefore quite accustomed to see philosophy and theology in a certain tension, and to criticize even Aristotle. One finds characteristic traces of this in his early marginal notes, attacks against the rancid philosopher, the inventor Aristotle, and against the shameless babbling that Aristotle is not in dissonance with the Catholic truth, should not be taken as the earliest documents of Luther's Reformation position, to be sure. But if we are to weigh all symptoms carefully, neither can they be disposed of as mere school jargon of Erfurt nominalism. Corresponding to the statement from the letter we quoted at the beginning of this lecture, in Luther's early utterances about philosophy and theology stirs a peculiar note. Its peculiarity lies in the forcefulness and its manner of accentuation. In the year 1518, a discussion between Luther and his former teacher, Jodocus Trutvetter, which is documented in letters, shows how careful one needs to be in referring to the Erfurt nominalism as an explanation for the Reformation. Luther confesses to his revered teacher that he was the first one to teach him that one owes faith exclusively to the canonical books, and that to all else one owes a probing judgment. Despite this compliment, Luther at the same time sees himself as far apart from his teacher as possible. For to Trutvetter, the prince of dialectics, Luther seems to be no logician. Luther concedes it. You think I am no logician. Perhaps I am not, but I know that I fear no one's logic when I defend my opinion. On the other hand, Luther considers this teacher to be one of those people who have come under the power of Aristotle and therefore unable to grasp the meaning of one single chapter of the Bible. One thing is obvious in this. Luther did not learn from Trutvetter the hermeneutical relevance of the anti-philosophical sentiments barely perceptible in his early marginal notes. In confronting the dominant philosophy of his time, Luther's chief interest was to make accessible for theology the genuine understanding of the Bible, which was not accessible to theology due to the obstructions of Aristotelian terminology and the Aristotelian formulation of questions. In contrast to the traditional use of language in scholastic theology, which was shaped by philosophy, Luther's fundamental exegetical tendency was, from the beginning, to grasp the uniqueness of the biblical mode of speech and thought. Thus, Luther asserts, for instance, that in contradistinction to the philosophical understanding of intellect as a capacity of man, the Bible understands this term as defined through the object, so that its formal understanding is overcome through the orientation to the subject matter. In the biblical understanding, true intellect is not an arbitrary content of knowledge, but the specifically biblical content that is the wisdom of the cross of Christ and hence faith. In contrast to this, the so-called human intellect is mere sensuality, which includes the human reason and is not capable of comprehending the spiritual things. To take another illustration, substance means in philosophy the inner essence of a thing. The Bible uses it as something which is external, something which supports a thing, that which furnishes strength, a basis on which to stand with both legs. That is, it uses this term as a sense of life provisions, that which gives us our existence. For the rich man, this would be his wealth, and for the healthy, his health, etc. The common element which the Bible shares with the philosophical concept of substance is the fact that both deal with the question as to what makes a thing a thing. Philosophy proceeds logically from the appearance to the timeless inner essence, that is, to the qualities of the things. It does this in the following sense. The essence in being rich, for example, lies obviously in wealth. Thus, wealth is a logical essence of the concept of being rich. In opposition to this, Luther asserts that the scriptures are not concerned with the qualities of the things, but instead with the qualities alone. That is to say, scripture is concerned with the external, and specifically with the external relations of a thing, its connection with other things, and conversely with the influences of the others upon it. The issue here is not, as we would say, the interest in the question about the orientation to the essence, but rather the orientation to the existence. At stake is not the question in view of its logical metaphysical reference, but the question with regard to its historical reference. In the biblical way of thinking, the fact that wealth makes the rich man, rich, implies, therefore, the aspect of time and of event, which is to say, he is only rich as long as his wealth lasts. at the same time the relevance of one's attitude to the circumstances also come into play. That is to say, the rich is only rich to the extent that he understands himself from the side of his wealth, insofar as he allows wealth to be the substance of his self and places his trust in it. Thus, it is almost up to man as to what he will consider his substance to be. Still different nuances of this are indicated in a third characteristic example. In Romans 8:19, Paul speaks of the waiting of all creation. Luther interprets this in the following manner. The apostle philosophizes and thinks about the things of the world in another way than the philosophers and metaphysicians do, and he understands them differently from the way they do. For the philosophers are so deeply engaged in studying the present state of things that they explore only what and of what kind they are, but the apostle turns our attention away from the consideration of things as they are now and from what they are as to essence and accidents, and directs us to regard them in terms of what they will be. He does not speak of the essence of the creature and of the way it operates or of its action or inaction and motion, but using a used and strange theological word, he speaks of the expectation of the creature. By virtue of the fact that his soul has the power of hearing the creature waiting, he no longer directs his inquiry toward the creature as such, but to what it waits for. So then you will be the best philosophers and the best explorers of nature if you learn from the apostle to consider the whole creature as it waits, groans, and travails in pain, that is, as it turns with disgust from what now is and yearns for what is to come. Then the science of the essence of things and of their accidental qualities and differences will soon become worthless. Thus, the foolishness of the philosophers is like that of a man who stands by a builder and marvels at the way the pieces and boards of wood are being cut and hewn and measured, and who remains stupidly content with it all, utterly unconcerned about what the builder finally plans to accomplish by all his labors. This workman is an empty head, and his work is pointless. In the same way, the fools or philosophers look at God's creature. It is constantly being prepared for the glory that is to come, but they see only what it is in itself and how it is equipped, but have no thought whatsoever for the end for which it was created. The academic world learned of Luther's sharp anti-Aristotelian thinking through the disputation against scholastic theology of September 1517. Unsparingly and in well-trained formulations, Luther here asserts that it is an error to say that no man become a theologian without Aristotle. Indeed, no one can become a theologian unless he becomes one without Aristotle. To state a theologian who is not a logician is a monstrous heretic. This is a monstrous and heretical statement. Briefly, the whole Aristotle is a theology, is to theology as darkness is to light. Especially noteworthy is the immediately following remark. It is very doubtful whether the Latins, the Western theologians, comprehended the correct meaning of Aristotle. Luther questions in other places too whether the scholastic Aristotle is in fact the genuine Aristotle. This is a notable suggestion, not alone for the necessity of a critical examination of the scholastic understanding of Aristotle, but especially for the actual point of departure for Luther's criticism of Aristotle. Luther is not interested in Aristotle as such, but in the application which has been made of him in theology. The question remains whether theology as well as Aristotle himself have been wronged in this way. In that case, Luther's criticism of Aristotle could in fact even imply a fundamental defense of Aristotle. However, Luther himself remains uninterested in such perspectives. His contention with Aristotle has to do with correct theological thinking. The actual access to what is at stake here is thus not to be gained through general anti-Aristotelian invectives, but only through an insight into the concrete theological context in which the application of the Aristotelian forms of thought are fatal. A decisive point for Luther is the Aristotelian psychology as a means of interpreting the event of grace. This is predominant in all of scholasticism, since it is at the very heart of it. And it was crystallized in the doctrine of grace. Analogously to the intellectual and moral virtues, grace is understood as habit of the soul, habit which perfects the spiritual abilities of a man, and which is also the quintessence of the theological virtues, faith, love, and hope. Aristotle has the familiar textbook example for a habit, namely that one learns to play the zither by playing it, which is to say that the ability develops through exercise of repeated acts. Luther alludes to this example when he emphasizes, we are not justified by doing the just, but as those who have been made righteous, we act righteously. This, however, does not refer to Aristotle at all, for Luther does not intend to attack the Aristotelian description of how a technical ability is acquired, nor its corresponding application in the realm of ethics, as long as this acquisition is seen as distinct from what is at stake in theology. Why should it be contested that a certain moral virtue can be acquired by practice? What is dangerous is not Aristotle's ethics itself, but its involvement in the doctrine of grace. Of course, the question must also be asked as to what extent Aristotle's starting point in ethics is fundamentally closed to what theology deals with. And furthermore, the objection must be considered that Luther's polemic against the Aristotelian scheme of the occurrence of a habit through repeated acts applies at most to the scholastic doctrine when it has been perverted by extreme nominalistic influences and not in its valid form. Scholasticism distinguishes very clearly between a self-acquired habit, as it exists only in the realm of natural virtues, and an infused habit bestowed as a gift with which the event of grace deals exclusively. However, Luther saw quite correctly that in spite of this, the interpretation of the event of grace through the scheme of the Aristotelian concept of virtue is the cause for mixing in the concept of merit and for the inability of defining sharply the distinction between the moral and the theological aspect. Thus, the attack which Luther launches against the scholastic conception of the relationship of philosophy and theology, both in its Thomistic and in its Occamist form, holds tasks which, for understandable reasons, Luther himself could not tackle. This does not mean, however, that they can be overlooked. They must rather be considered as a legacy for future considerations in the post-Lutheran world. Luther himself has accomplished important preliminary preparations for this. However, these are merely beginnings which need to be completed. Firstly, Luther's criticism of the scholastic thought patterns charges us with tasks in which the work of theology is in contact with the work of philosophy. That is to say, we need to work out appropriate concepts and terms of reference for the questions concerning speech about man in his historicity. Not in the sense that theology is simply to be handed over to another philosophy instead of the Aristotelian. Theology is itself accountable for its language. But the conversation with philosophy is part of this accountability. Theology would not be accountable theology, however, if it were to isolate itself in this accountability for its own language. For it also bears the responsibility for the language of philosophy. Up to now, philosophy has paid in some regard more attention than theology to the kind of language appropriate to what Luther thought about man in his historicity. Secondly, the disputation on man of the year 1536 is an impressive example of the fact that Luther did not simply play theology off against philosophy. He reflects the relationship in its differentiations as a relationship of distinction, which gives to each of the two its own sphere. Correctly understood, man's reason is indeed something divine, if it would maintain its limits and confine itself to the subject, that is, if it were truly reasonable, then one could not value it highly enough. On the other hand, the kind of reason which tyrannizes the conscience and puts itself in God's place must be destroyed by faith. Luther says, must be killed by faith. Luther's theology leaves for us the task of continuing the explication of the relationship of theology and philosophy in the light of his extreme statements about reason. Thirdly, and closely connected with this, is the necessity for us to think through Luther's understanding of theology with reference to its implicit teaching about the theological understanding, that means with reference to its implicit hermeneutics. In the following lectures, we shall take some of the basic problems of his thought, which have come up for the first time today, and we shall try to shed further light on them from various sides. I think.